Supercritical salutations from the World Aerogel Summit 2008 in Providence, Rhode Island. You're listening to The Critical Point on aerogel.org. I am your host, Steven Steiner. As part of our continuing series, The People Who Reinvented Aerogel, it is my distinct pleasure to be sitting down interviewing Professor Stephanie Brock from Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan. Dr. Brock is best known for her work with semiconducting metal chalcogenide aerogels, an entirely new class of materials with multiple exciting applications for the future. Dr. Brock, welcome.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
To start off, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? Where do you come from? What did you study in school? And what got you interested in aerogels?
Sure. I'm basically from the West Coast. I was born in Alameda, California, but my family really lived mostly in the Washington area, so I grew up there. I was very interested in French and very much interested in drama and choir in high school. I actually neglected to take any chemistry or physics until I got to college, when I did decide to become a chemistry major, regardless. So, from chemistry, my foray into aerogels occurred when I was doing a postdoc. So I received my PhD from UC Davis, and then I went and did a postdoc at University of Connecticut with Steve Soup. And while doing a postdoc with him, Deborah Rollison from the Naval Research Lab came and gave a seminar, and she was talking about aerogel materials. And she had recently gotten into this field. And what she had to say about them was so exciting to me that I, you know, immediately decided that this was something that I wanted to work on when I had my own faculty position.
It was interesting that you mentioned Deborah Rollison. She seems to be the progenitor of many aerogel research groups.
Yeah, I think that, what Deborah has done is she's really expanded the range of materials and the way we think about aerogels in general. So if you look very traditionally, I mean, chemists didn't really work on aerogels, okay? So you sort of had silica, and then there was a lot of engineering folks. And I think part of it is, I mean, I would say that in chemistry, there's always been this prejudice towards things that are ordered being aesthetically pleasing. So the thought of working on a system where you have random pore sizes that are basically randomly interconnected, you don't have a high degree of order on any kind of length scale. So, I mean, even as an undergraduate, I was working on highly ordered materials, and we were using X-ray crystallography, single crystal work, as our primary means for figuring out the structure. So to go to a system where you say, look, you know, we don't have that kind of order, but it's okay, I think is something that was difficult for a lot of chemists to get a hold of. But I think what's exciting is the fact that because there hasn't been a lot of more fundamental chemistry research in aerogels, I think that it really provides an opportunity for somebody to come in and basically say, well, gee, we should be able to do it with this, we should be able to do it with that. And there were places where they were doing that. But you know, handfuls of groups, just a few places. It's been really small. And Deborah really came in and basically thought about it from a very different perspective. Rather than thinking about it, well, it's a novel insulating material, she thought, well, this is a great nanostructure that we could use for battery applications. And then once you sort of turn it on its head, then other people can come in and say, wow, it could also be this or it could also be that.
A different perspective.
Yeah, very different perspective. I think that's important.
So let's talk about different perspectives. You once told me that you didn't start out in chemistry when you started college. You actually were a French major initially.
I was a French major.
So how did you transition from being a French major into being a chemistry professor?
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, I would say that I'm definitely the kind of person who never wanted to leave school. So you could say that an academic position was something that I was going to go towards. I'm also somebody who, my mother never got to go to college. My dad had some college. My parents were very adamant that I would go to college. And I went to college, but without having really any clue about why I was there or what I was doing. My mother was always very much into the fact that you should always be prepared to take care of yourself. And she, you know, even though I loved French and all of this kind of stuff, you know, she would say to me, she'd say, look, you need to choose a major where you're going to be able to support yourself if you need to. Because ultimately, no matter what happens, you need to be prepared to support yourself. And so she was encouraging me to be an engineer or something like that. I knew nothing about this. Basically, the way I got into chemistry was because, you know, the advantage of a U.S. education is that they believe in general education requirements. And so even as a French major, I had to take science credits. And I decided chemistry would be fun and that I would look cute in a lab coat and I would get to play with all of these kinds of things and that would be great. And what I found was, you know, when I took chemistry, I didn't like the class very much, but got into the lab and decided, you know, that was something that was a lot of fun. And I could do this, even if I wasn't going to be very good at it. I could certainly do this. And then I started to do research, undergraduate research. My undergraduate advisor, I did my BS degree at the University of Washington. My undergraduate advisor was Jim Mayer. I just recently saw him. He came out to Wayne State and gave a seminar. And, you know, he basically took me in. He gave me my own vacuum line. He gave me my own desk. He gave me my own project. He really gave me a sense of ownership. I got to know the graduate students. I got to watch him. And basically I thought, you know, gosh, I just can't imagine a better job than becoming a faculty member.
I had a similar experience as an undergrad. My professor, my advisor was Professor Bob West at the University of Wisconsin, and mm-hmm. he wasn't, because he was retired, he couldn't advise graduate students, mm-hmm. so he only had postdocs and undergrads, and the undergrads became his de facto grad students, so we got desks, we got Schlenk lines, and it was very similar, and that's very empowering, just having the opportunity to mm-hmm. get hands-on and do some
and
chemistry
to, makes
a big difference.
To have the respect, to have your opinion valued.
Exactly. Absolutely.
I mean, I really, you know, towards the end, I lived in the lab. I mean, that was where I was training graduate students. I was a valued member of the team, and it really was, I felt very special and privileged to do that.
Certainly the work you've done with metal chalcogenide aerogels is your best known work and some of the most exciting work being done in the aerogel arena. Could you tell us a little bit about that? Where did it come about? What exactly is a metal chalcogenide aerogel? Why do we care about them?
Well, that's a great question, and thank you very much for actually saying that. You know, it's pretty novel. We think it's pretty novel, but it's nice to hear that other people feel the same way. We really got into this area from purely serendipitously because I am an academic. Therefore, I could do hypothesis-driven research, but I can tell you that that's not usually the way my ideas come. Usually my ideas come as sort of a, gee, wouldn't it be wonderful if you could do this? And then after it's done, you say, gee, how am I going to justify having done what I've done? And so really we started in aerogels, and I'd had no experience with this with my first student, and we were working on a silica-based system because silica was something, if you're going to get into it, you want to start with something that's fairly basic. I was reading the literature and you know, read this paper about sulfide gels. And thought, well, gee, I wonder if anybody's ever made a chalcogenide gel, aerogel. You know, they made the wet gels. They look very intriguing. And so we did a literature search, and, you know, nobody really had. And we thought it was very novel from two perspectives. From one perspective, it's the aerogel community. Okay, nobody's made aerogels based on metal chalcogenide frameworks. And the metal chalcogenides being sulfides and selenides. So moving down in the periodic
cadmium
table from
sulfide,
oxide.
Cadmium sulfide.
So, and we were specifically looking at ones that are direct band gap semiconductors. We thought that would be interesting because it also provides some properties that are not represented by the conventional oxide materials. So these are direct band gap semiconductors that absorb in the visible spectrum. So for solar applications where you want to have absorb solar energy, these could really be very advantageous over oxide systems. So you have this advantage of novelty from the perspective of what's been done with aerogels. You also have an advantage of novelty of interest in the issue of how do you take semiconducting nanoparticles, or quantum dots as they're called, which have been a very hot topic in the literature because you can basically tune the optical properties and luminescence with the size. How do you take these tiny little pieces of matter and integrate them into a solid state device? And so from our perspective, well, if you could take them and make an aerogel out of them, then you've made a solid state device where they're
something you could hold in your
hand. Physically connected. Yeah, you've made something macroscopic that you can hold in your hand. So we really saw this as sort of bringing these sort of two different communities together and sort of appealing to two different areas by doing these studies.
So why don't we talk a little bit about quantum dots? So
okay.
A quantum dot, for those of you who don't know, is a nanoparticle. And stop me if I say something stupid.
Okay.
A nanoparticle, generally made out of a semiconducting material, so silicon, cadmium selenide, cadmium sulfide,
cadmium phosphide, zinc sulfide, lead selenide. These are all what we call semiconducting materials, which means that, and of course, you know, we know that silicon is the backbone of the computer industry, right? Information storage. The reason why semiconductors are so powerful is because you have the ability to control how charge is distributed. So you can basically, you know, excite electrons. You can separate charges within a semiconductor and control the conductivity in that way.
You can
make something
that's conducting electricity or not conducting electricity based on
that's
how you
right,
control
based
the charge.
On, based on how you control the charge. And so, you know, you can use electrons as information, basically. So there's a lot of real interest in those kinds of materials. Now, the quantum dots is a special phenomenon that happens when you take a semiconductor And what's magic about a semiconductor is that you have billions and billions of atoms that make up this semiconductor, and they all combine together. They all have orbitals that they all basically throw into a pot. These orbitals all overlap. They form what we call bands. They're continua of energy levels that can be occupied by electrons. In a semiconductor, you have a filled band and an energy gap to the empty band, and that's what it is. You have to put in enough energy to get an electron to go to the empty band in order to have any conduction.
So the meaning of this, for example, in the case of a light emitting diode, which is a familiar semiconductor device, is if you apply enough voltage to it, it will light up. The electrons will jump up,
an electron,
and then when they jump back down, they emit a photon.
That's right.
But if you don't use a high enough voltage, so if you don't use enough batteries, the LED won't turn on, and that's because you don't have enough energy to excite that band
gap.
That's
exactly right. So what happens in a quantum dot is when you say, okay, everybody throws their orbitals into a kitty and we separate them into these continua. If you don't have very many orbitals to contribute, then what happens is you can't really make these continua. What you end up with are some very discrete quantized states, and the energy gap between the highest filled state and the lowest empty state is larger than it is in a bulk semiconductor.
So that means
and
if we,
it's size dependent. So,
so we shrink our semiconductor down into a nanoparticle, then the band gap of the material
actually increases.
And as we continue to shrink that nanoparticle,
it keeps increasing.
So what is the ramification of that? Why do we care?
The ramification is that there are several different ramifications. One is that you have intrinsically different properties than you will ever get from a bulk semiconductor. Because when you have something like the electron falling back down to recombine, in a bulk semiconductor, there are a variety of levels this can happen from. So you have a very broad emission. In a nanoparticle, they're falling from one state to another. So you get very narrow kinds of emission properties.
So you could potentially make LEDs with very specific, pure colors.
Oh, yes, that's right. That's certainly the case.
And in fact, light-emitting
diodes, and you could do it for a variety of different applications. There's interest in biological probes. Another interesting feature of the quantum dots is you have the ability to generate what we call multiple excitations. So you could use a single photon, a very high energy, to excite multiple electrons within your nanoparticle system. For example, a holy grail would be water splitting to produce hydrogen and oxygen. Okay, that would be fantastic if we can do that. Nature does that. And so if you could, for example, excite with one photon and get four excited electrons that you could then use in your process, you'd be in very good shape.
You could start thinking about generating
hydrogen. Or two electrons for hydrogen, you know, taking protons to H2 gas, you know. But that's a two-electron process. And normally what happens is you excite with a photon, you get one electron. One electron isn't going to do it for you. It falls back down before you can excite another one. In these quantum dots, you have the ability to generate multiple excited electrons. So there are a variety of things that are truly unique. There's also the ability to basically tune the properties by just tuning the size, which really enables you a lot of flexibility in terms of particular applications, in terms of marrying it to other materials and being able to really control where electrons and holes, which is what's left over after the electron is gone, where they're spatially located.
So if we were to think about LEDs again, by changing the size of the quantum dot, we could change the color
of
the LED.
Oh, you absolutely do. That's exactly what happens.
And in reverse, we could think about making a solar cell out of quantum dots then.
Oh, of course.
And by tuning the size of our quantum dots and laying them down on some device somehow, we could make a solar cell that's sensitive to very specific colors of light and maximize
most
of the
spectrum. What you normally do is you envision sort of a graded cell where you would have a variety so that you could absorb over the entire region of interest.
But the difficulty, as you mentioned before, with something like quantum dots, which are nanoparticles, is they're loose and tiny. We have to somehow manage them. We need to assemble them together into some kind of a useful structure that's the size of a solar cell or an LED or something that we can actually do something with. And so now we think about aerogels made out of quantum dots. That's a macro form of quantum dots that we can suddenly do interesting things with. So how do you make that transition from a bunch of loose quantum dots, say in a solution of a liquid, and render them into a continuous solid form like an aerogel?
The way that it works is, well, let me back up a minute. The way that you make quantum dots, the way that we make quantum dots and chemists in general is from what we would call bottom-up techniques. So we start with molecules. We react these molecules together to make a solid. But when the solid starts to get big, we have in solution, we have capping groups, we have ligands that will go and bind to the active surface and prevent it from continuing to grow. And so we would refer to this as an arrested precipitation reaction. Yeah, these things come in, they form a little piece of solid, the solid starts to grow, but then because of these groups that are present, you can actually stop that growth.
So they kind of
nanoparticles.
Coat the particle
they coat
over.
They coat the particle surface. They
prevent it from growing.
Yes, they prevent it from growing. They basically moderate the reactivity. They shut down the surface reactivity.
So then after this all the smoke clears, so to speak, you have a bunch of particles floating in your solution,
right.
And they've all stopped growing. They're all sort of hanging out.
So what you want to do is, if you want them to form a gel, then what you want to do is you want to take off some of the ligands so that they can once again react. But you have to be careful how you do it, because if you remove them all at once, then you're just going to get a precipitate or uncontrolled growth. What we really want is to form a solvent swollen polymer, a connected network of nanoscopic objects that are basically supported by the solvent in which they form. So what we do is we use ligands that are, we specifically use thiolate ligands, so these are sulfur-containing ligands that we can actually oxidize in an irreversible fashion.
Peel off, so to speak.
And they peel off irreversibly and produce patches on the particles, which can then find other patches on particles and basically assemble together.
So effectively, we have this protective shell. Mm-hmm. We rip part of the shell off in a controlled fashion, leaving behind sort of a stickiness that allows particles then to assemble together and begin to form this shell network.
And we say it's a controlled fashion, but we're not really controlling it. It just turns out that...
Control-ish.
You know, if you're careful, control-ish. If you're careful about the kinds of oxidizing agents you use, and you have kinetics of reaction, the number of reactive sites that are produced is low enough that you can form a gel rather than forming a precipitate.
So once you have these gels, you simply supercritically dry them like a typical gel to
That's exactly what we do. We actually just supercritically dry them so that we can remove the solvent without causing the framework to break up.
So once you have the aerogels, what do you do with them? Why are they exciting? What should people look forward to as being possible now that you've been able to make these types of materials?
Well, we've actually been, and once again, I mean, I am a basic researcher. I'm interested in fundamental questions, but we have been doing research, and we have some collaborations, and we've put in some grants to basically look at these for different energy applications. So specifically photovoltaics or components in photocatalysts. There's a lot of interest in photocatalysis for using the multi-exciton generation to do water splitting.
To generate hydrogen from water.
Yes, to generate hydrogen from water.
Sunlight.
Hydrogen from protons. You have two sides. You have one side where oxygen is being oxidized to form O2, and the other side where protons are being reduced to form H2. So you'd like to be able to exploit some of these multiple excitons to do the proton reduction. But, you know, ultimately you're going to need to have that on some kind of a solid scaffold. You want to connect it up to a cell, right? Which means that you want your quantum dots to be physically connected together. The same thing is true for photovoltaics. If you want to separate the electrons in holes and make them do work, and the electrons in holes being generated from solar exposure, then what you need is you need to have facile paths for electrons in holes. And what's been done currently is individual nanoparticles within a hole conducting polymer. And that really limits the electron conduction. So we're hopeful that by having these physically linked together, we will have better conduction, better conductivity, and therefore more efficient photovoltaics.
How do aerogels made of metal chalcogenides compare to single crystals of metal chalcogenides, so the typical form factor of these semiconductors? So let's take the case of cadmium sulfide.
Uh-huh.
Cadmium sulfide is a semiconductor used in industry.
Mm-hmm.
You can even buy little photocells at Radio Shack.
Oh, okay, right. Yes, yes.
And so those are, in that particular device, we have a tiny little sliver of crystalline cadmium sulfide,
mm-hmm.
which is a macroscopic material.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So how do the properties of a material like that compare with the properties of a cadmium sulfide aerogel?
Well, I think the aerogel material, because it's made of quantum dots, are going to have a very different band gap, because you're going to have these discrete states, once again, that you're accessing. But I think more than that, what it offers is a different kind of photovoltaic architecture to be sampled. So there's always been interest in flexible photovoltaics and inexpensive photovoltaics. Single crystals are very expensive. They're very efficient, but they're very expensive. And in some ways, if you had something that was not very efficient but was cheap, it could compete. And so people have looked at polymers for photovoltaics. And the problem is the polymers are not very good conductors of electrons. And that's where this sort of network would come in, because you could basically take this porous structure. And because it's porous, you ought to be able to basically combine it on the nanoscale with the polymer. and basically excite it with light, create electrons, create holes. Holes get transported to the polymer portion, and the electrons are transmitted through the quantum dot network. So you have this kind of intimacy for electron hole separation that you don't have, and a much larger footprint for this to occur than in a thin film or a single crystal.
Overall, it sounds like most of the potential applications you're looking at are pertaining to energy, and particularly ways that we can cleverly transform solar energy into electricity or into hydrogen.
Well, I think that's really the defining issue of our time. And I think it's something that we should all really be thinking about. The bottom line is we have all the capabilities. We can do all of this. We already know how to do this. We've known how to split water for a long time. What we don't know how to do is how to do it economically. We don't know how to do it efficiently. And we're not going to figure out how to do that unless we do research on it. And that brings you full circle, because in order to do research on it, there has to be funding to do research on it and a will amongst the community that this is important. And so, you know, what's happened is energy has become a very important issue locally because of the price of gas, but it should have always been an important issue. We have a long ways to go in terms of environmentally sustainable energy requirements.
So the motto of aerogel.org is open source nanotech. Mm-hmm. We're trying to take what is one of the oldest nanotechnologies, aerogels, mm-hmm. and bring it to the public in a way that they can understand it and also participate in it, get
right.
involved, learn chemistry in the process, mm-hmm. perhaps be persuaded to pursue college or graduate education in chemistry and continue in the aerogel field. Do you think that aerogels are a good avenue for making changes, making the world a better place in regards to energy?
I absolutely think that that's the case. I think that there are many different ways you can go to solve problems, but aerogels, they have some very unique features, and they represent a nanostructure that is tried and true. It's been very well demonstrated with silica, and I think can offer similar kinds of potential based on other kinds of frameworks. So I think that aerogels can play a very important role, and I think that what has happened in the past is everyone sits around and they go, oh yes, but these are niche materials. Oh, but they're fragile, so you'll never be able to do anything with them. Oh, but supercritical drying is a pain, so you're never going to be able to do this. But you know what we've seen is that people find ways around these things. None of these problems are insurmountable. So
we have flexible aerogels.
So
now.
Yeah, so they're fragile.
We have some
so
critical drying
them
now.
We've got, you know, various types of subcritical drying or ways in which supercritical drying can be made economical.
Like Aspen Aerogels does.
Yeah, like Aspen Aerogels does. Like folks at Union College do, where they have a rapid supercritical extrusion method. You know, there are various ways around all of these problems. And what's really defeatist is when, you know, you sit there and you say, well, oh, it'll never work because... And now, I don't know what really makes for a good product. I'm an academic, and I get a headache when I think about all of the specific requirements to really make a product good. But what I know is that, you know, we have sort of the ingenuity and the know-how to answer fundamental questions that I believe will lead to really good products from the people who really have the expertise, the know-how, and the desire to drive that.
You've outlined some of the barriers in the energy industry and some of the things that we need to start thinking about and how aerogels can play into that. As far as the aerogel community is concerned, what do you see as being the biggest obstacle to progress? What, if we could fix this one problem, would enable aerogels to take a greater stand on the world stage in helping address energy problems? Is it a perceptual barrier? Is it a technological problem? Is it funding? What is it that the aerogel community needs most to address right now?
I would say that what it really needs is more people who are interested in working on it. I have more ideas than I know what to do with. In terms of chemists, which is what I know most about, who are doing really novel work, I mean, there aren't very many groups that are doing that. There could be many more. There's so many different things you could do with this. And they really do have the ability, I think, to capture the imagination. Anybody who's seen a picture of an aerogel, you know, is easily inspired. I mean, you were inspired in that way, right? You set up your own autoclave and basically made your own aerogels.
Right.
I think that it really has the potential to get people excited, but it hasn't. And I think I alluded at the very beginning to this sort of, at least among chemists, this sort of adherence to highly crystalline, highly ordered materials. There's an aesthetic argument. There's also a question of, if you're going to answer very detailed fundamental questions, you need systems that are very well defined. And aerogels are perhaps not well defined. You have to give up some of what you're willing to know about in order to access the possibilities there. And so I think it's really just a question of, I mean, I think that hopefully we'll come on board because there's more crossover now between chemistry and materials and physics and other communities than there ever has been before. And so my hope is that, you know, as that goes, there'll be more and more people involved in aerogels. And I can tell you that, you know, since I got into this field, I know several other groups that have started to work in aerogels too. So there are some people who are picking it up. And I think that's really the critical thing is to have sort of a critical mass of researchers.
You said you have more ideas than you know what to do with. And I know there's some really exciting things in your group that are either tangentially related to metal chalcogenides or very different from metal chalcogenides. You've mentioned being able to make aerogels out of unusual nanostructures, nanobarbells, nanotetrapods, other types of nanoparticles that aren't just little spheres. You also mentioned making materials out of phosphides, another class of aerogels which simply didn't exist before. Can you talk about what's going on in the Brock group and some of those exciting developments?
Sure. But what we've been really working on lately, well, we have a number of different projects. So one thing we are trying to do is we're trying to show the properties that might actually be suitable for these applications. So I spend a lot of time walking around saying, well, these could be lovely for photovoltaics, and people say, well, have you done? Well, we haven't done anything about it yet. So we're starting to. This is well outside my area of expertise, but it's something that we are learning about. So one thing we're doing is really trying to look at these for photovoltaics. We also have a project where we're interested in thermal to electrical conversion based on more dense types of structures of small band gap semiconductors, things like lead telluride. One thing that we're really trying to do that I think is going to have an impact on understanding how these are, how they conduct electricity, because that's something that we've never really probed explicitly, is understanding what the mechanism is. So what is the chemical bonding like at the interface between particles? So we have a project to really sort of understand that. What are the chemical characteristics of these particle-particle interfaces, as well as projects to sort of make new materials, as you said, by either varying the properties of the individual particles, so varying the shape, thereby changing the morphology of the aerogel, or varying the composition, so saying, well, could we do this with phosphides instead of sulfides and selenides? And even doing post-modification. So if we make a zinc sulfide gel, can we turn that into a lead sulfide gel by just ion exchanging with lead? So those are the avenues that we are currently exploring.
As Deborah Rollison put it, aerogels were nano before nano was even invented.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly is the case that your research highlights this in a very fundamental way, that aerogels are nanostructured materials, that mm-hmm. that they're made of nanoparticles, and that they're, even though they're something we can hold in our hands, that it's all about what happens at that nano level, changing
right.
One little thing, shape of the particle, changing the way they bond together, changing the chemicals that the particles are made out of, drastically affects the properties of the material.
Right.
As a successful woman in science, what would you have to say to young women out there who are interested in pursuing science or who don't know yet that they might be interested in pursuing science?
Well, I would say that I think it's a great area to be in. I mean, I have just enjoyed the opportunity to really think creatively about the world around me. I think that it's certainly true that women are underrepresented in the sciences, and they're underrepresented among the faculty, and there's been a lot of conversation about why that is the case. And I do think that there are certainly, you know, there is an old boys club that is basically beginning to fragment and be more open. And I would say that, you know, what you should do is you should always just follow your bliss. You should decide what is most satisfying to you. But it's very important also that you demand your fair rights. So you should not have to make any sacrifices that a man, you wouldn't ask, for example, you wouldn't ask a man to not have children to have a career. And, you know, a woman should not be asked the same thing, you know, under threat of getting tenure. So I would say that, you know, it's just important that you do what it is that you really want to do. And I always felt that when I was making the decision to become a faculty member, I wasn't sure it was going to work out because I sort of refused to do probably to take the most traditional path. So I could have gone to any place I wanted to after the University of Washington. But I turned down places like Caltech and Northwestern to go to UC Davis, which is an excellent school, okay? But it's not Caltech or MIT. And those are the places that people usually go to if they want an academic position. But what I decided was when I went and visited, that UC Davis was a place where I felt they were really interested in the science. They weren't on their high horse. There didn't seem to be a lot of pretension. They were just interested in doing good science. And I felt that I needed to be in an environment that was, you know, a good environment for me. And if they told me I couldn't have a faculty position, well, then fine. I would go off and do something else with my life. So it turns out that wasn't an issue. But I definitely made a priority. And I know plenty of people who have sacrificed. They've chosen to take tempered positions where they were not very happy for the long-term goal of what they wanted. And I basically decided that I wasn't going to do that. I needed to enjoy the whole process.
Well, it seems that it's worked out pretty well so far.
Yeah, so far it has worked out pretty well. That's why I guess I give it as advice. It worked for me. I hope it works for you too.
You seem to be very interested in fundamentals and exploring new ideas, trying things that are out of the box. And even Samuel Kistler, the inventor of aerogel,
right.
Seems to have had a similar mindset. He made a number of strange aerogels right on the onset. Could you maybe talk about the value of trying things out of the box and perhaps some of the consequences of doing that?
Well, I think that that it's certainly one of those things where it's always good to do the quick and dirty experiment. And sometimes it's good not to think too hard about things because you will talk yourself out of them. As a faculty member, it's always very advantageous to have graduate students because frequently they have less information than you do. They're less informed than you are. And so they will often do ill-advised experiments that turn out, in hindsight, to be quite brilliant. So the advantage is that, you know, what chemists really, or at least my vision of science, which I always thought was kind of strange, I would say that scientists are all masochists. Because you sit there and you go, I'm going to make this prediction. You know, I predict that if I mix A and B, I will make compound C. And you go in the lab and you do the experiment fully hoping that it does not work, fully hoping that instead of producing compound C, which you can imagine, you produce compound D, which nobody has imagined before. Okay? So we go in there hoping to be proved wrong, hoping to discover something that is bigger than anything that we could actually imagine. And frequently the way you get to those things is by doing experiments that are maybe not the best thought out. It's important that they're safe experiments, but there are reactions that you would sit there and you would say, well, this is just not going to work. And then, you know, you do the reaction and, wow, something really interesting happens. So I think that, you know, what I would say, and I remember there was a faculty at UC Davis, Bill Power, who used to say, you know, the saying goes that an hour in the library will save you a week in the lab. And his comment was always, you know, a week in the lab will save you an hour in the library. So sometimes it's worthwhile just to go in and try some things without thinking too hard for it. I mean, what was said about having a prepared mind is very important. I mean, the important thing is that if you do something, if you get something unexpected, you recognize it for what it is.
In parting, do you have any advice for our listeners who are contemplating getting into aerogel or perhaps trying to build a supercritical dryer on their own, as we've outlined on the make section of our site, or perhaps simply just trying to make some of the gels that we've talked about today?
I say go for it. I mean, I really think that you're a real inspiration. I mean, I sit there and I go, wow, you actually went and thought about this and you did all of this stuff on your own. And I don't know that I ever had like the chutzpah to do that without some formal training. But I certainly think that, you know, the older I get too, the more I imbibe this lesson. And when I was young, you know, I was always afraid of making mistakes and doing the wrong thing. And now what I say is, you know, it's great. There, you know, you try it. Don't be afraid, you know. Give things a chance. And so I would say, you know, if you think that these aerogels are interesting, don't be afraid to follow what's on the webpage. Don't be afraid to call up some of the people who were interviewed and ask them questions.
That's what I did.
I mean, and we're not going to, you know, I mean, we sit there and we go like, oh my gosh, there's somebody out there in the real world who's actually interested in what we're doing. So we're not going to like hang up on you or anything. We, you know, we're tickled pink. So.
That's certainly a lesson that I learned when I was in high school, is that most scientists are not only tolerant of answering your questions, but delighted to answer your questions.
Well, it's certainly the case that I think that, you know, we walk around in this, you know, with this sort of reputation of being inaccessible, and you know, we walk around with this notion that, oh, people, you know, nobody likes to take science classes, oh, they're a drag and stuff. So you know, when somebody comes up to you and they say, you know, I really enjoy it, and I hear both sides, right? I hear, oh, you're a chemistry professor. Oh, God, I hated chemistry. And then I get the, you know, it was so hard. And then I get these people go, oh, yeah, I really enjoyed chemistry. And it's those latter people, you go, wow, you know, that's so, so good. You know, it's so nice to know that, you know, some people really do, you know, enjoy this. You know, I'm not a freak. Other people enjoy it, too. Even normal people.
Stephanie Brock, one of the reinventors of aerogel. For aerogel.org, I'm Steven Steiner, reminding you that aerogel's not just for NASA anymore. Log on and get involved.